point here is that quality salmon habitat is at a premium, and we can ill afford to lose so much of it at the headwaters of our greatest remaining wild fishery.
The EPA has a plan to restrict development of the Pebble Mine. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state Supreme Court issues an important decision on tribal court jurisdiction.
These tribes do have authority to adjudicate children's cases. That basic premise has not changed.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
The EPA has released the details of how they plan to use the Clean Water Act to put in place protections in Bristol Bay from the possible negative impacts of the proposed Pebble Mine. KDLG's Mike Mason reports.
For the last several months, the EPA has been working on its proposed 404C determination focused specifically on the proposed Pebble Mine and its potential negative impacts on the Bristol Bay region. Section 404C of the Clean Water Act gives the EPA the authority to prohibit or restrict fill activities if the agency finds that such activities would have unacceptable adverse effects on fishery areas. The proposed determination, released early Friday morning, would restrict all discharges of dredge and fill material from the Pebble deposit that would result in the loss of 5 or more miles of streams with documented salmon populations. The restrictions also apply to the loss of 1.1 thousand acres of wetlands, lakes, and ponds that connect with salmon-bearing streams. Additionally, the proposed restrictions also apply to significant stream flow alterations in 9 miles or more of those same streams. In making the proposed determination, the EPA stresses that it's directly focused on protecting the Bristol Bay salmon fishery, which is considered one of the healthiest and most valuable salmon fisheries on Earth. Dennis McLaren is the administrator for EPA Region 10. He spoke to the importance of the Bristol Bay fishery during a press conference Friday morning.
In Bristol Bay, over 14,000 jobs are supported annually by the incredibly high-value, consistent annual return of almost 40 million salmon every year to this area. The point here is that quality salmon habitat is at a premium, and we can ill afford to lose so much of it at the headwaters of our greatest remaining wild fishery.
The EPA based their Bristol Bay watershed assessment and the subsequent proposed 404C determination on the belief the proposed Pebble Mine would be one of the largest open-pit copper mines in the world. That mine would sit on land owned by the state of Alaska in the headwaters of the Nooshigak and Quijack River watersheds. Those two rivers are among the most significant salmon-producing rivers on Earth and supports a traditional way of life in the Bristol Bay region, as well as a massive commercial fishery. This year, the fishery produced a sockeye salmon harvest exceeding 28 million fish. McLaren says that level of annual production deserves protections.
So it is a special and remarkable place, and the information that we've compiled to date about what drives the fishery there shows that the functions of headwater streams and wetlands are incredibly important to the overall productivity of the watershed. And so, you know, especially at the sizes that would be likely to occur in the watershed, our initial determination from the region is that it would create unacceptable adverse effects.
The proposed 404C restrictions outlined Friday by the EPA don't preclude the Pebble Mine developers from filing for permits, so it doesn't necessarily constitute an outright veto of the project. Pebble Limited Partnership spokesman Mike Heatwall says the partnership is thankful for that.
That said, we fundamentally don't accept that the EPA has the authority to impose conditions before having a full and thorough review under the permitting process. We've talked about this before, but we're still battling this cart before the horse issue. All we have sought throughout the entire roll-up to this point is the ability to bring forward a detailed development plan and have it fairly and thoroughly evaluated by all the relevant state and federal agencies under the terms and conditions that have been set up for development in Alaska and the United States.
The Pebble Limited Partnership still plans to move forward with permitting the proposed Pebble Mine. However, they're holding off on submitting permit applications until they find another partner to join the partnership to replace the giant mining companies Anglo American and Rio Tinto. Both of those corporations have divested themselves of their investments in the Pebble Mine project. Friday's proposed 404C determination by the EPA starts a public comment period that begins Monday and runs through September 19th. The EPA has scheduled several public hearings in Alaska on the proposed determination. The hearing in Anchorage will be held August the 12th, followed by six hearings in the Bristol Bay region. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The Alaska Supreme Court issued a decision today in a long-running tribal court jurisdiction case. The case stems from a Minto Tribal Court decision that terminated parental rights. The father, Edward Parks, was not a Minto tribal member, so he claimed the court did not have authority over him. He tried to take the case to state court and bypass Tribal Appellate Court, saying he was not allowed oral presentation of his argument. Natalie Landreth is an attorney with the Native American Rights Fund, the legal organization that defended the adoptive parents against the biological father's challenge. She says there were two areas of legal clarity provided in the decision. The first is that a plaintiff must exhaust the appellate process in tribal court before taking a challenge to state court.
The second is that it didn't adopt what the state vigorously argued along with Mr. Parks, which was this idea that you have to be allowed to present complex things in an oral argument format or however they want to characterize it, basically trying to say that tribal courts have to look like state courts. And the court rejected that, said that's not the case.
What about the issue of tribal court authority over another tribal member who is not from that community? Was that at all settled in your mind in this decision, or is that still out there?
Well, I think that's going to depend on the circumstances of cases where you might have an odd fact pattern. But this decision does pretty clearly say the jurisdiction is over the child. If that child happens to be a member of that tribe, then that tribal court is going to have jurisdiction. That, again, is not groundbreaking. What they did was cite the other Alaska tribal court case that we had in the past couple of years, which was the Caltag decision. Judge Burgess said exactly the same thing. So, again, they did make a decision on that, but they're not way out on a limb.
Does this provide, in your mind, does this provide then more clarity for how the state should see tribal courts and their jurisdiction?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Each one of these cases that we've been working on for years is a separate step forward, a different piece of the puzzle, which says what we've been advocating all along, which is that these tribes do have authority to adjudicate children's cases. There may be 31 different flavors of that, but that basic premise has not changed. And this case is another piece of that puzzle.
Natalie Landreth is an attorney with NARF. Alaska Attorney General Michael Garrity says the decision was not far-reaching.
The court decided the case on fairly narrow grounds that the Mr. Parks had not exhausted his tribal court remedies. And so, you know, I think we've learned something from the opinion, and that is positive in the sense that people, litigants before tribal courts, need to avail themselves of all remedies and appeals before the tribal courts, before they go to state court.
When you say that this is a narrow decision, are you saying that in your mind it's not settled law then that the tribal courts have authority beyond their immediate tribal members?
That question was not decided. Which is, you know, did the tribal court have jurisdiction over Mr. Parks, a non-member who had never lived or resided in Minto? I mean, you can read some things in the court's opinion, but ultimately it didn't reach that issue, which is the one that the state was weighing in on when we intervened.
Why is it seen as an important fight for the state to challenge tribal court authority, given the problems in rural Alaska and the need for help in administrating justice in tribal communities? What's the long-range concern about tribal authority that keeps the state arguing against some of these tribal court decisions?
Well, I think Mr. Parks' case was terminating his parental rights. that's not, in the grand scheme of things, probably a public safety issue. So, I mean, we do need to make progress on that front, and on that, you know, we're not challenging tribal court authority on that front. We're looking for ways to work with them to improve public safety. The case of Mr. Parks, and dealing, when you're dealing with family issues that are under the Indian Child Welfare Act, the issue is, like Mr. Parks, they're citizens of Alaska. They're guaranteed certain rights under the Constitution of our state. And when they go to state court claiming that those rights have been trampled or not observed, they have not received due process, yes, I take an interest in those.
Michael Garrity is Alaska's Attorney General. State officials have confirmed rabies in a bat in southeast Alaska. The state health department said biologists on Prince of Wales Island last Sunday trapped several Keen's myotis bats, one of which was acting more aggressively and seemed possibly sick. It was euthanized and tested for rabies. The test came back positive Thursday. The two prior cases of confirmed rabies in bats in Alaska were in 1993 and 2006, both in southeast. Louisa Castrodale, an epidemiologist with the state, says Alaska doesn't have a huge bat population. She says the department wants to ensure anyone who may have been bitten by a bat doesn't discount their possible risk of exposure. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a Southeast artist who blends the traditional and the modern in his weaving.
Learning this and practicing it and really identifying as a weaver has reconciled my nativeness and my gayness.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
The helicopter to Diomede is flying today. The first flight to the island took off around 11 o'clock this morning after a new contract was formally signed by Ericsson Aviation, Coweric, and Federal Department of Transportation officials yesterday.
Whatever all the signatures, all the final ones came through yesterday. As soon as I got back, there was a phone message for me and a couple emails saying, go ahead and get going.
That's Mike Katiba, the Nome-based pilot and manager for Ericsson Aviation. He says as soon as he got the word, he started getting ready.
As soon as I got the aircraft tied down, I immediately started calling people that had missed flights over the last couple of weeks and set and got a flight up ready to go for today.
Little Diomede has been without regular helicopter service since June 30th after the contract with Ericsson lapsed. Mail delivery has continued. The Federal Department of Transportation and Coweric have worked since May to hammer out a new contract, which leverages nearly $340,000 to keep the service running under the Essential Air Service Program. But a new proposal from the aviation company didn't come until early June. As of today, Katiba says Ericsson is flying twice a week to the island, passenger service on Monday, weather permitting, with mail service on Wednesdays. Governor Sean Parnell was in Bethel yesterday to sign a bill intended to help rural families navigate the process of having an autopsy done hundreds of miles away in Anchorage. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
When someone in Western Alaska dies in suspicious or unusual circumstances, the state is required to conduct an autopsy or exam in Anchorage. Sometimes, in the time of stress, family members are making decisions without good information. In a packed room of regional leaders at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation Thursday, Governor Parnell signed a bill into law intended to make that stressful time easier.
This is about dignity and respect for our lost loved ones, as well as for dignity and respect for the families that are involved.
The bill makes explicit that families can choose to have the body returned directly to them instead of a funeral home. Bethel Representative Bob Heron sponsored the bill.
It's hard on the family because they want closure. They want it to be done right. And in the past, no fault of anybody's, but the state appeared to be promoting the funeral home business.
Part of that was the documentation for families, which has been changed. Supporters cite stories of people getting stuck with large funeral home bills they couldn't pay. That's led to some funeral homes holding the body hostage until they get paid. Nicholas Hoover is the Social Services Director for the Association of Village Council Presidents and works with families in need. He says good communication hasn't always happened and points to a recent $7,000 funeral home bill.
If a family isn't prepared, you know, they can tack on services like embalming, which is, you know, toxic, and it's not traditional custom, you know, to have a body embalmed. Preparation or cosmetics is another. Traditionally, the family is the one who dresses the body and prepares it for a funeral.
The law also allows for the possibility of some exams to be done outside of urban areas in a hub like Bethel with video equipment. That could cut down on the approximately 900 cases the medical examiners see annually. Dr. Gary Zintek is Alaska's chief medical examiner. He says there are no plans yet to establish a rural examination program, and the requirements for facility and training are steep.
Photographs and fingerprints, and you know, we have to do a lot of documentation, so it would be a lot of training, but it is probably possible, but it requires a lot of work before we do that.
The law would pay for embalming if required by an air carrier and could return the body to places besides the exact location of the death. The governor also signed resolutions in support of Alaska's role in National Arctic Policy and of Recover Alaska's efforts to reduce excessive alcohol consumption. He also spoke at the Bethel Chamber of Commerce. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
The city of Fort Yukon plans to build a new landfill. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the project is aimed at improving safety and recycling some of the community's waste stream.
Like many villages, Fort Yukon has a pretty basic way of dealing with trash, a dump.
Once in a while, somebody goes out there and lights it off, and you get a big black smoke you can see for miles.
City Manager Paul Schufelt lists numerous problems with the dump, including its proximity to the village airport, which results in birds attracted to garbage flying near airplanes, a situation he describes as an accident waiting to happen.
They get crows and seagulls flying around out there. Any kind of bird strikes by an airplane, you know, you can lose 5-6 people from the community.
Fort Yukon's new landfill will be in a safer location, on acreage donated by the Village Corporation. Schufelt says the water table there is too shallow to bury trash, and they've developed an alternative approach.
We're going to try to separate it into 12 self-dumping hoppers, compact the trash, and store it above ground.
Bales will be stacked on a gravel pad and covered with dirt, but not everything will end up like that. Schufelt describes a plan to burn paper and send out other materials like aluminum cans for recycling.
Try to send the aluminum back on our charters. We have planes that come in. If we can palletize them, you have 800-900-pound bricks of aluminum cans.
Schufelt says a successful shift to the new waste management system hinges on the public.
This is going to be a test, a community test, to see if we can pull this off.
Schufelt is waiting on state approval to move ahead with the landfill project, hopeful it can be completed before winter.
It'll be great. We don't have to look at that dirty dump site that we have now.
The new transfer site and landfill infrastructure is being paid for with a $500,000 state grant. The cost of city solid waste operations is expected to double to $160,000. A 1 cent increase in the local sales tax to cover it will be on the October municipal ballot. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. Enroll now for health care benefits. Yukon Kuskokwim Village veterans can enroll at the Veterans Standdown event at Bethel August 1st through 3rd at the Old Armory Killbuck Gym. Learn about VA, state, and community programs, meet with staff, enjoy a free meal, and receive free military surplus gear. Apply early at 543-6705. This message sponsored by the VA.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Lisa Fu. This week on AK, weaving. It has long been forbidden for men to weave in the Chilkat tradition, but Tlingit artist Ricky Tagaban is an exception. Using techniques practiced for thousands of years, Tagaban creates his trademark iPhone bags, hair clips, and headbands, putting a modern spin on an ancient tradition. KTOO's Annie Bartholomew has the story.
In his living room overlooking the Gastineau Channel in Juneau, Ricky Tagaban is spinning wool and wet cedar bark together on moose hide. The process joins the fibers together, creating something called warp, which will give Tagaban's bags their structure. With a big celebration cultural event just a few days away, Tagaban still has several commissions left to fulfill. Those finished pieces vary in size and intricacy. They all begin the same way, as cedar bark softening in a crock pot.
Cooking it is kind of the longest part. And then I soak the bark in hot water and spin it with the wool, and I have to wash it and groom it. And that part, that's called grooming your balls. And you have to go along and cut all the fluff. And that's all before weaving.
Tagaban is weaving in the Chilkat tradition. The textile technique is passed down through Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian families, and there are strict rules guiding its practice. Created on an upright loom, Chilkat uses abstract shapes and patterns inspired by nature. Much of what's known about Chilkat came from the late master weaver, Jenny Clinat. Juneau weaver Lily Hudson Hope has been practicing both raven's tail and later Chilkat weaving since she was a teenager.
I feel like the traditions and the rules and the taboos are set there, and they're there to protect us.
One of the taboos in Chilkat is to never place a human hand in designs. Another is to always cover up your work after you're finished. But the one that applies to Tagaban is that men can't weave. But Hope says there is one exception.
We don't know why it started or where it started, but when Jenny was teaching my mother and other weavers in 1986, she would scream, "We don't teach men. I don't teach men. We don't teach men." And then she made the exception that if they're funny, and she said, "If they're funny, I teach him." They're funny in the way that they're two-spirited.
By two-spirited, Hope means gay. In the summer of 2010, Tagaban was invited to learn from Clinat's apprentice and Hope's mother, Clarissa Rizal, because he fit the tradition and was identified as someone who could carry it forward.
I was asked to learn this style of weaving because of my sexual orientation, and it's a native art form. So learning this and practicing it and really identifying as a weaver has reconciled my nativeness and my gayness.
Since learning Chilkat, Tagaban's work has become more elaborate and experimental, incorporating more modern materials like shotgun shells. This spring, Tagaban was awarded his second Rasmussen Grant, and one of his iPhone bags appeared on the red carpet in Los Angeles at the GLAAD Media Awards. Hope thinks it's exciting to see the way Tagaban has brought Chilkat to new audiences.
He's taken an ancient art form and put it in the hands of the masses in a way that's revolutionary. We don't have to wait for celebration or for cultural gatherings to share our art form with other people. It's not just for Tlingit people or just for Haidas or Tsimshian. It's like, if you like this and you want to wear this, come have some. Come get it.
Back at Tagaban's home studio, he lets me try on a pair of leggings, decorated by deer hooves. They're a work in progress, an old-world object with a twist. Embedded in the traditional Chilkat pattern is a small patch of geometric raven's tail weaving, a hybrid design that's just beginning to gain acceptance in Chilkat. For Tagaban, harmonizing both aspects, the modern and traditional, is important.
It's cool to have like a really specialized skill. It's also kind of a lot of pressure. It's not that we're saving it, it's just that we're holding on to it while we're here.
The leggings are almost finished. Tagaban just has to sew sea otter fur to the tops before he can see them danced at celebration. In Juneau, I'm Annie Bartholomew.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to the tiny interior village of Dry Creek.
My name is Tom Nurbon, and I live in Dry Creek Community, and we run a sawmill here that supplies firewood, lumber, timber, and wood chips to the surrounding area. It's right at the base of the Macomb Plateau, and it's a very pretty spot. Of course, the winters here are still long, so that's kind of fun. We send timbers all over the state, basically. We send timbers up north to Prudhoe, all the way down south to Kenai.
you know, doing the cabin kits where they're all pre-notched and pre-cut and assembling them in different locations out on remote places on rivers and lakes is probably one of the kind of funnest things to do. Yeah, we've been all over the state. So we go to Kenai, we go to Fairbanks, Polk, Eagle. We've been everywhere putting up places. We sent a log home kit over to Lebanon, over the Mediterranean there, and we actually have a cabin sitting on the road from Beirut to Tripoli. Yeah, it's pretty cool. It was a pretty cool arrangement, and everything worked out, and he got his cabin, we got our money, and he was happy. It's pretty neat. Our main wood is white spruce that's grown here locally, and it's a state timber sale that we harvest. My favorite thing to do is probably break out the snow machine and go ride, and there's no one within miles of here, so you can just go anywhere you want. It's just a great place to live and raise your kids.
Tom Nurbon runs a sawmill in Dry Creek. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. If you want to hear your community featured, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK This Week. We had help from Annie Bartholomew, Joaquin Palomino, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Lisa Fu.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Mike Mason in Dillingham, Matthew Smith in Nome, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.